Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are very, very pleased to have with us to discuss several topics of considerable significance at the moment, a man who has distinguished himself as a constitutional attorney, as an author, notably of The Authoritarians, which talks about the history of authoritarianism going back to the 19th century right up to the present moment, and a man who knows his way around the Supreme Court and the Congress when it comes to preserving our constitutional freedoms. In fact, I think his concern about those freedoms has inspired him to run for the United States Senate from the Commonwealth of Virginia in the upcoming 2024 election. His name is Jonathan Emord. He's a good friend and very valued contributor to this program. We're delighted to have him with us. Jonathan, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
We have shared in the past a mutual concern about the erosion of our sovereignty that now seems to be increasingly an agenda item, shall we say, of not only foreign adversaries, but of our own government, the Biden administration specifically. This is evident in their efforts at both the World Health Organization, a subsidiary of the UN, as well as the United Nations General Assembly itself, to impute to those organizations powers that are clearly reserved for our own government under our Constitution, and that would be weakened dramatically were these sorts of changes to be effected. I'm very keen to get your thoughts on this issue of sovereignty, the importance of it, of course, but also the advisability of allowing these sorts of things to take place without the express approval of the United States Senate as laid out in our Constitution.
It's a clear end run around the advice and consent clause of the Constitution to have the executive branch asserting its independence of Congress in engaging the United States in international agreements and agreeing to terms that invade our sovereignty all across the board. And the effect is essentially a Soros-backed opioid is being consumed by the Democrat Party leadership, by the president, in favor of transforming the United States from an independent nation into a subsidiary of some international movement that is largely directed by the Communist Chinese. The Communist Chinese have found international organizations to be the greatest ally in their efforts to divorce us of our rights and interests, domestic control. And that is clearly what is at work here. And yet we have no alarm bells being sounded by the State Department, no alarm bells, of course, being sounded by the president, who seems all in for this. And the leadership in the Democrat Party in the Senate and in the House, but particularly where they have power in the Senate, is all against this. We saw Ron Johnson's bill go down. Tim Kaine led the charge on that to eliminate that bill, which would have just merely asserted the constitutional power, which is for advice and consent. So the Founding Fathers understood well that they could not allow a president of the United States to engage in entangling alliances internationally that would deprive the American people of the protections that are afforded by the constitutions and laws of the United States. I mean, both federal and state constitutions and federal and state laws. And yet here, what they're doing is basically the same thing they did with the executive orders. They're violating the separation of powers, and they're doing it instead of simply directly acting by the president. He's using international proxies to take that case and make it without, again, the advice and consent of the Senate or any input whatsoever from the American people. So it's an authoritarian move. It's very frightening. And we ought to be getting ourselves out of these international organizations altogether rather than using them as proxies to achieve some sort of a totalitarian agenda that will enhance the power of the president and diminish the power of the people and their representatives in Congress.
You've made several points that are really crucial here, Jonathan. One is, I think, the authoritarian character of what's being undertaken here at the behest of the Chinese Communist Party, make no mistake about it, through what is not so much, it seems to me, an ally as a real proxy for their power grab, is alarming in the extreme. Notably, this idea that there will become global digital IDs that will be used to monitor health conditions around the world and the, affect the surveillance, really, of individuals globally. This is a perfect vehicle, of course, for imposing the infamous social credit system of communist China on all of us. And I think that's the kind of thing that ought to send off alarm bells all by itself. But your other point that I think is in need of further emphasis is the founders were so concerned, as I understand it, that international agreements or treaties specifically could debase, essentially, or otherwise eliminate our constitutional rights and freedoms, that they not only required the Senate's advice and consent as a central part of the treaty-making process, but they required a supermajority, right, two-thirds of the Senate, to approve these kinds of agreements. And this idea that, as you say, with Tim Kaine's support, but that of every Democrat voting, the Senate essentially waived its constitutional duty to do this kind of quality control on what may come out of these international health regulations amendments or even a new pandemic accord. They sometimes slip and call it a treaty, but it's not supposed to be called that for this very reason. But those two points, it seems to me, are of surpassing importance. And I just wanted to thank you for making them so well. And to emphasize, again, as a candidate for the Senate, you clearly appreciate the importance of the Senate performing this role, do you not?
Oh, it's critical. It's a constitutional requirement. But your point about the digital currency, which is, you know, another point which we can raise, digital currency, also a massive invasion of privacy, but also having these digital credit card type of health information, digitized health information, which is ubiquitous in the government circles, being able to invade your privacy to the degree of understanding every single ailment. And in addition, by the way, your movement, where you go, what drugs you will take, where you're obtaining those, where you are going, traveling, and so forth. All of this is another huge invasion of privacy.
Your social media content, for that matter, what you're thinking, who you're associating with. I mean,
and
this
then
is
the
totalitarian of the first order.
It certainly is. And their interest, of course, is with ESG in mind, with categorizing people based on their political sentiments and denigrating those, giving... You know, we already have a movement afoot with hospitals under pressure from CDC to deny treatment to people who refuse to be vaccinated. And this, of course, would...
And all of that will be reported and made known to authorities globally under this World Health Organization...
That's right.
...empowerment initiative. Jonathan, we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back with more. I want to pick up on a point you just touched on, ESG and more, with you on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Three senior Pakistani officers recently lost their jobs on the grounds that they had failed to keep the government's opponents from launching attacks on the military's assets. This time, the perpetrators were supporters of an Islamist former prime minister. The next time, they may well be jihadists doing business as the Taliban, ISIS, or Al-Qaeda, operating from neighboring Afghanistan, who are determined to overthrow Pakistan's government and seize its nuclear weapons. As former CIA undercover operative Charles Sam Faddis has pointed out, this would be just one of the dangerous upshots of Joe Biden's ruinous surrender of Afghanistan. Another is likely to be that these and other terrorist groups, now upgunned with $83 billion worth of our weapons, are gaining unprecedented power to pursue their ultimate objective, which is to destroy us. What's being done to prevent that? This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. Jonathan Ebert is in the house. He is a constitutional attorney by trade and training. He is the author of The Authoritarians, a book about the practice of essentially totalitarian rule going back to the 19th century. He is also a candidate for the United States Senate at the moment. And we're talking about issues that bear upon the sovereignty and the economic prosperity, and I would argue the national security of the United States. And I wanted to come back to something you touched on just at the tail end of that last block, Jonathan, that is this agenda known as environment social governance, or ESG. Recently, the prime mover behind this, a fellow by the name of Larry Fink, who is the chairman and CEO of a gigantic Wall Street enterprise known as BlackRock, some $10 trillion under management, has said he is henceforth going to eschew the use of that terminology, ESG, the acronym for Environment, Social Justice, and Governance. My sense is that doesn't mean he is abandoning the agenda of ESG, just that as the left does, they're going to try to find new euphemisms to obscure what they're up to. We did a fascinating webinar under the sponsorship of our Committee on the Present Danger China last week on this subject, and established, I think, beyond question that ESG is really just another vehicle for trying to effect the takedown of America, specifically free market capitalism. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, economic liberty is a precious liberty, although denigrated by judicial determinations that have lowered the standard of protection from that which is accorded political speech, for example, that is strict scrutiny. They've lowered the level to rational basis review, which means that the regulatory state proceeds apace in the area of the marketplace. Now, this was not the Founding Fathers' intention at all. The Founding Fathers intended, they were well-versed with the Wealth of Nations. It was published in 1776. Adam Smith was foremost among those that they considered for issues of economics. They rejected the mercantilist system of government control there. And of course, they hated taxation as a vehicle to abuse the people's liberties and direct their resources to things other than what they intended. This is a modern day gloss on that. This is a new affront directly aimed at destroying your freedom of choice. It is designed to both intimidate you, invade your privacy, intimidate you, and also force you to support causes and endeavors that you oppose.
So now, when you say this, you're referring to the agenda of environment, social governance, ESG.
That's right. And I think that any time you interfere with market processes to influence people, let alone compel them to align with political causes and agendas that they oppose, you violate their First Amendment rights, but you also fundamentally violate their economic liberty. Now, in the modern day environment, we have to proceed based on First Amendment causes of action, typically, to get the higher standard of review. But the Founding Fathers did not distinguish between economic and political liberty. They understood liberty to embrace both. And they would have viewed this the same way they viewed the efforts by the Crown over taxation, to manipulate, intimidate, and force them to adopt and adhere to an agenda that they opposed. Yeah. And this is the problem.
Let me just explore a little bit further what BlackRock has been doing in this regard. They have been not simply insisting that corporate America embrace their priorities with respect to the environment, with respect to the sort of, as they say, social justice agenda, the whole Black Lives Matter business and beyond, critical race theory for that matter, and governance arrangements whereby, you know, leftists are put on boards of directors to sort of retool corporate America. But they're also, it seems, increasingly now directing the sort of tradition of shareholder capitalism, the fundamental profit motive of free market capitalism, into something they call shareholder capitalism, stakeholder capitalism, whereby, you know, interested parties can dictate what corporate decisions are, maybe very much against their bottom line interests and those of the shareholders. Just talk us through how, you know, the implications of such a transformation of free market capitalism could feed into, as you say, the worst authoritarian impulses and impoverishing of our country.
Well, when you remove or destroy profit motive as a basis for market operation, you no longer have a free market. You no longer have it. If profit motive is at the very heart of a free market, as Adam Smith said, we do not obtain our bread and milk from the benevolence of the butcher, bread and beef from the benevolence of the butcher, but because of their pursuit of their own self-interest. Mm-hmm. And self-interest, profit motive, is indispensable to the operation of a free market. You replace that with a political agenda and you force people into an environment in which profit motive is no longer the predominant factor. You end up with nothing more than socialism, and you end up with impoverishment.
Yeah.
And the people, everybody who depends upon corporate wealth, I mean, the entire economic structure then collapses. You talk about the reserve currency being the dollar. Watch how quickly the reserve currency becomes something else, probably the Chinese yuan.
Yeah.
Watch how quickly that happens when you destroy the infrastructure of capitalism in America. And this is exactly what this is designed now to do. It's also corporatism.
That's the point.
It's corporatism because it's giving those leaders of this movement effective de facto control over the essential corporate environment, not just their own corporation, but through government and through the manipulation of currency and through the manipulation of shares. Mm-hmm. And through the manipulation of corporate governance, complete annihilation of capitalism.
Yeah.
And the destruction, more importantly, the destruction of every individual's economic value in the dollar, in their choice of exchange. You lose freedom, you lose choice, you lose opportunities in the market.
Yeah.
And you instead
and become... To say nothing of impoverishing yourselves. And really, this is the... I think principal takeaway from our webinar, which, by the way, folks, is available for free at presentdangerchina.org. I strongly commend this to you. It was last week's show. But Jonathan, it's clear that one of the principal beneficiaries of such a takedown of our economic engine of prosperity and thereby our ability to afford a military capable of protecting our vital interests here at home and elsewhere around the world is the Chinese Communist Party. And the fact that Larry Fink is doing absolutely nothing to require of Chinese companies conformity with ESG, and as with climate change and so much else, the Chinese have absolutely no interest in being bound by these kinds of things that they want to have imposed on their Western counterparts. It's another example of his betrayal of our yes. country and that of others like him, who I think are properly called friends of China, but I believe increasingly should be understood to be enemies of the United States. We're going to have to take a short break. Last one before we complete our conversation with Jonathan Emord about immigration, the Supreme Court, and more right after this.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Jonathan Emord, a very important figure in, I think, the public intellectual community, especially in his area of expertise, which is constitutional law. He is an attorney by training, specializing in matters of constitutional law, and also a candidate for the United States Senate from the Commonwealth of Virginia, the author of The Authoritarians. And we're talking about authoritarianism in our time here at home, Jonathan. And one other aspect of the undoing of our country, we talked about ESG and similar kinds of fundamental assaults on our sovereignty as well as our economy, is what's being done at the border in terms of allowing seemingly limitless numbers, millions of illegal aliens to flood across it year by year. Talk to us about this as a fundamental breach of the compact between the governed and the government under our Constitution, and the implications of this for our society and elections and more.
Well, it's a fundamental assault on Americans' life, liberty, and property. Notice that when you open your borders to anyone and you turn over American immigration policy to criminal cartels, you end up with a entirely predictable, destruction of lives, liberties, and property. So we have MS-13, 18 street gangs pouring over the border. We have terrorists pouring over the border. We have Chinese nationals in the age groups that are indicative of military age people pouring in hundreds of times greater than in previous months, all taking advantage of this. And then we have drug
including many of them Chinese nationals, no less.
So drug trafficking, sex trafficking, arms trafficking, any amount of criminal activity that you can define, resulting in murders, rapes, criminal trespass, destruction of property, looting, and so forth, and complete annihilation of border towns, overwhelmed and subsumed under a sea of criminality and abuse. And note what is happening with the government. Does the government do anything, the federal government, do anything at all to protect Americans' lives, liberties, and property here? No. They're allowing this to happen writ large, and they're ignoring it completely when it comes to American citizens' rights. When it comes to their favoritism for those entering, they're giving massive benefits to those who are entering. They're not vetting them at all. We have people here who are loyal to their own countries, which are many times enemies of the United States, never having to renounce their citizenship of those countries, and had pledged allegiance to the United States. We have over 17 million illegal immigrants in the United States presently. And the result of all of this, of course, is the destruction of American sovereignty. We are losing our protections for life, liberty, and property. We're losing life, liberty, and property. We are losing our identity as a people. We're losing our legal protections across the board. As you know, Donald Trump said this many times, if we don't have borders, we don't have a country. Well, that of course is the case. The Constitution presumes borders. The Constitution requires defense of the nation, of citizens. Citizenship is a requisite not only to voting, participation in our polity, but in addition to that, citizenship defines who you are under the Constitution. There is the Oath or Affirmation Clause of the Constitution, requiring every executive officer, every member of Congress, every elected official, state and national, to pledge allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and uphold it. And these are fundamentals that define the Founding Fathers' commitment to a republic, to a defined republic based on geographical borders that were protected. We make a commander-in-chief principally out of the president, the founders did, for the purpose of protecting our sovereignty, protecting our rights. So when you have this deluge of foreign nationals totally uncontrolled coming into this country, wreaking havoc and causing destruction to lives, liberty, and property with a commander-in-chief who does nothing to protect them, what we have is a total abnegation of constitutional obligation by the president, by the Congress, which to the extent they're complicit in this, and of course by Department of Homeland Security under Alejandro Mayorkas. A total disaster.
Do you believe that this kind of conduct warrants the impeachment, for example, of Mayorkas, and arguably the president of the United States as well?
Sure. I mean, the president has many, many bases for impeachment, not least of which is the Foreign Emoluments Clause because of his illicit dealings as vice president with foreign powers and accepting money from foreign powers and putting it in his own bank account and using it to pay for his own properties. But the point is, yes, the impeachment power should be used. Now, remember, you can impeach and not remove. I mean, we might not want to have Kamala Harris become president of the United States. But if I were in Congress right now, I'd very much be in favor of impeachment of Mayorkas, removal of him, impeachment of Merrick Garland and removal of him, and also impeachment of Joe Biden. But let's take the removal, let's make it the last day of his time in office. But there needs to be justice. There needs to be an application of equal justice under law. Look what they did with Donald Trump with no foundation, with no evidentiary foundation, with ample evidence of criminality and of a violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause and of a failure to fulfill his duties as Commander-in-Chief and to protect the nation's borders and to implement the immigration laws. He and Mayorkas, you know, amply justify impeachment, and that's important. It's important for us critically to defend the Constitution, and it was designed for this very purpose, to ensure that those that committed high crimes and misdemeanors were made to account.
Yeah. Well, as someone who has repeatedly taken that very oath supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States, for which there is, by the way, no time limit, it does seem to me that if you do not hold people accountable for breaching it, you can essentially kiss goodbye the government of the United States doing what it must to perpetuate our constitutional republic. Jonathan, I wanted to ask you quickly, because of your expertise, to comment on the role that the Supreme Court has been playing of late, with respect, among other things, to upholding the Biden administration's enforcement, if you will, policies with respect to immigration, in the case of, you know, striking down efforts by Louisiana to challenge what's clearly misconduct in that space.
Yeah, I don't agree with the decision that found no standing for the purpose of hearing the case. That was a procedural decision. They didn't reach the merits in that case. Nonetheless, on the merits, I think it's very clear that it should favor the challengers here against the government because of the extraordinary nature of this. This is a clear failure to enforce the immigration laws. There's been no change in those laws by Congress. As a result, the president's unilateral action is a violation of the law and should have been so found. It's a usurpation of the role of the Congress by determining a new policy in its place. So the issue is, did they properly decide to find no standing in that case? I think they should have found standing. I think that there are direct, immediate, and remedial injuries that were suffered by the states and should have been so recognized. They determined that this was essentially an internal policy matter of the administration, having no direct nexus to the injury suffered by the states. I think that that's a mistake.
I concur. Let me ask you finally about another assault on really our society, I guess, as much as our rights. That is the effort that's been made in the name of transgender rights to impose upon schools, sports, women's sports in particular, the government itself, I guess, as well, certain standards that essentially invite sexual abuse. You wrote about this earlier in the month in Town Hall magazine. Give us just a quick course on what you see as afoot here and its implications.
So having lost this battle in Congress, the president then turned to the Department of Education and had them implement, it's imminent. That's a proposed rule that's imminent in its adoption. To implement through the executive branch, through the Department of Education, a rule that will affect every institution that receives federal funds, which will mean every school, every hospital, every public place, every park. And this rule will require the bathrooms and locker rooms and sports teams of women and girls to be immediately open to any male that declares himself female. So simply by a male declaring himself to be female, that male will be able to enter into all of those private spaces of women and girls. And this, of course, will mean that perverts and sexual deviants who prey upon women and girls will simply use that moniker with the full force of law behind them to protect them. And they will enter into these spaces, and there will be a massive uptick in rapes and sexual assaults. And this will cause, this is going to have numerous horrendous effects.
Yes.
Some that may be potentially beneficial, actually, strangely enough. Girls, I mean, if you're a parent, you have a female child in a school, you're not going to have urinary tract infections as the common order of the day by having girls refuse to use the bathroom while at school. You're going to pull them out of the schools.
Yeah.
Because, I mean,
this may well be the upshot of it. Yeah, homeschooling may see a considerable upsurge at a high, very high price for the society, though, that's for sure. Jonathan, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today and your expertise on all of these matters. Come back to us soon, if you would. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Three senior Pakistani officers recently lost their jobs on the grounds that they had failed to keep the government's opponents from launching attacks on the military's assets. This time, the perpetrators were supporters of an Islamist former prime minister. The next time, they may well be jihadists doing business as the Taliban, ISIS, or Al-Qaeda, operating from neighboring Afghanistan, who are determined to overthrow Pakistan's government and seize its nuclear weapons. As former CIA undercover operative Charles Sam Faddis has pointed out, this would be just one of the dangerous upshots of Joe Biden's ruinous surrender of Afghanistan. Another is likely to be that these and other terrorist groups, now upgunned with $83 billion worth of our weapons, are gaining unprecedented power to pursue their ultimate objective, which is to destroy us. What's being done to prevent that? This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. And now a very special guest, a friend and colleague of many years who graces this program with some regularity, for which we are extremely grateful. His name is Ambassador Yoram Ettinger. He represented his nation, Israel, in the United States for quite some time, notably as a liaison to the United States Congress in the embassy in Washington with the rank of ambassador. He is these days the editor of a marvelous newsletter, The Ettinger Report, and commentator of great insight, I think, on many portentous developments in the region of the Middle East, both for the people of Israel and also for us. And the thing that we value so much about Ambassador Ettinger is his ability to help synthesize what is afoot there that is not, again, just of interest to those in the neighborhood, but very much to the American people as well. Mr. Ambassador, it's great to have you back. Welcome once again.
Thank you very much.
The UN Security Council issued a presidential statement yesterday that in the UN sort of inimitable way was more or less morally equivalent in denouncing violence between Israelis and Palestinians. There is violence taking place. It seems to be ratcheting up. Is moral equivalence appropriate in this matter? And if not, what is the ground truth as you see it, sir?
Well, I'm not so concerned about the UN. I'm much more concerned about the fact the current position of the UN of moral equivalence between the killing of terrorists and the killing of Israeli civilians or Israeli soldiers, that position literally is the position of the current State Department. And that plays into the hands of the terrorists. In fact, it provides tailwind to the terrorist. And fundamentally, when one talks about the UN, one refers to an anti-American organization, a platform of anti-American opinion ranging from radical Sunni and Shiite terrorists all the way to Russia and China. And again, the current State Department prefers to establish common denominator, common front with the UN rather than pursue an independent American action. As far as Israel is concerned, we always prefer an independent American national security action than a cosmopolitan or universalist or multilateral position, which usually reflects the position of anti-American elements in the Western world and certainly throughout the Third World.
Yeah. I mean, this is such an important point. Unfortunately, what you've described is not just, it seems, defaulting to a multilateral consensus, the lowest common denominator of which is typically, as you say, hostility to American interests. And I think a dumbing down, really, of our understanding of what those interests are. But worse, it seems as though what we're confronting here, and most especially you and Israel are, is a rather determined hostility on the part of the Biden administration towards Israel. And this is simply being dressed up as kind of moral equivalence. As if I got that right from your perspective, sir?
Well, I'm very concerned about the position of the Biden administration, but I'm much more concerned about the position of the Biden administration towards Iran than I am with the position towards Jerusalem or towards the controversial Israeli control of Judea and Samaria. The position of the Biden administration on Iran, just like the position on the Muslim Brotherhood, has concerned every single pro-American Arab regime in the Middle East and has been a cause of celebration by the enemies of the U.S. and by the rivals of the U.S. But since day one, January of 2021, the Biden administration has pursued such a policy on Iran, on the Muslim Brotherhood, and on terrorism in general, preferring to deal with terrorism through diplomacy rather than using a military club to minimally threaten the terrorist into compliance with peaceful coexistence, or actually using that military club. The current administration abhors the military option or the regime change option, and therefore, unintentionally is serving the worst interest of America's worst enemies in the world today.
Yeah. And that means, essentially, in this case, emboldening the Iranians, does it not? And that translates again into diminished support for the U.S. position, as well as real jeopardy for the U.S. interests, both in its own right as well as those of its friends. And again, it's just hard to explain the fixation that this administration, I think of it really as Obama-Biden 3.0, you know, the continuation of misbegotten policies dating back to the first Obama-Biden administration. As many of the same personnel, of course, are involved in this one. And their policy attitude towards, as you say, not just Israel, but towards Iran, towards the region, is as misbegotten as ever, I'm afraid, and it's extremely ominous, especially when you add into the mix China. And Mr. Messer, we have to take a very short break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about China's role in the Middle East as you see it now, and a trip headed there in the near future, apparently, by Benjamin Netanyahu, what that portends, not just for Israel, but for us as well. We'll be right back with more with Ambassador Yoram Medegar right after this. Welcome back. We're visiting with the author of the Edinger Report, Ambassador Yoram Edinger, a very distinguished longtime ambassador and diplomat with the State of Israel, and man of great perspicacity when it comes to not just the interests of his own nation, but those of the United States in a very troubled region. Mr. Ambassador, we were talking about Iran, the U.S. government's policy towards it, the extent to which it is seemingly encouraging and, frankly, I'm fearful, emboldening a regime that remains as determined as ever, as best I can tell, to have nuclear weapons and to be engaged in destabilizing the region, threatening the State of Israel, most obviously, but also newfound friends, if I can use that expression very loosely, in Saudi Arabia, brokered by communist China in recent months. Talk a little bit about the role China is playing as you see it in the region and its implications both for those most immediately involved, including your nation, but for our interests there as well.
Well, China's enhanced posture in the Middle East owes its current stature to the U.S. U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt has pushed those three basically pro-American Arab Sunni regimes closer to the arms of both China and Russia. It's not only that the U.S. has pressured those three pro-American Sunni Arab regimes, but while they're pressuring the pro-American regimes, they have courted anxiously the Ayatollahs in Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood, two elements which constitute lethal threats to the pro-American Arab regimes in the Middle East. It's not only a diplomatic rapprochement between the UAE, Egypt and Saudi Arabia on the one hand, and China on the other hand, it's also the acquisition of Russian and Chinese military systems by some of those countries. It's also the negotiation with China for the construction of a nuclear power station in Saudi Arabia, and it's mostly due to the State Department's policy. The Saudis would prefer to deal only with the U.S., but with the U.S. sending them the very obvious signs of disengagement and of pressure, they leave the Saudis especially, but also the Emiratis and Egypt, with no choice but to look for another global power in order to avert the wrath of the Ayatollahs of Iran.
Which brings us to Israel. Israel is similarly being, treated, as we said earlier, in a manner that encourages it to look elsewhere. What would you anticipate is likely to come from this trip by Benjamin Netanyahu, as yet as unscheduled, as I understand it, but now expected to be in the future, not so distant future at that. What is the likely upshot there, as you see it, sir?
Well, in order to put the coming visit to China in proper perspective, one should realize that while the State Department and the White House are leaning heavily on Israel, pressuring Israel, the reality of commercial and especially military cooperation between the two countries is at an all-time high and keep surging forward. This has been the story of U.S.-Israel relations for many, many years. On the one hand, pressuring Israel usually on the Palestinian issue, but at the same time realizing the very unique capabilities by Israel, technological capabilities, defense, commercial capabilities. And this is the reality today. We're not looking for Chinese military systems. We're not looking for cooperation with China defense or aerospace industry. In fact, Israel refuses to deal with China in those areas. In my opinion, and I don't claim to have firsthand knowledge, but logically speaking, the prime minister will go shortly to China. Number one priority will be Iran. China has very close ties with Iran. China wants to expand its foothold in the Middle East primarily through investments. And I think the message by the prime minister to China will be, for the sake of your interest in the Middle East, you should be very active to avert the wrath of a nuclear Iran. Likewise, by the way, with Saudi Arabia. China has very close ties with Saudi Arabia. Israel is interested in closer ties with Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, is also the Saudi interest. And the Chinese could play a role, which sadly the U.S. currently, under the State Department's policy, refuses to play. But I think the message by the Prime Minister to China would be enhanced commercial ties, enhanced technological ties between Saudi Arabia and Israel would contribute to Middle East stability and therefore would be a positive effect on Chinese interest in the Middle East. Last and not least, I hope and pray that the Prime Minister will not acquiesce with Chinese pressure or Chinese request for Israel to commit itself to more concessions to the Palestinians or to accord the UN a prominent role in negotiation with Palestinians. That would be a very devastating mistake on the part of Israel, and I hope that the Prime Minister will not take this road while in China.
I very much hope so, too. Seems as though these conversations have a lot of downside risks associated with them. We'll be following them closely with your help, sir. Thank you for your time today. Join us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same as soon as possible. Tomorrow, if possible. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Until then, go forth and multiply.